you talked to already? You're the first.
Waiting.
We've been waiting for an hour.
Sorry.
The
director we talked to.
We need her.
Wayne and Georgie and Andrew.
Yeah.
All right. I had nothing to say.
Since you're the writer, I'll start out with kind of a little bit loaded question. the character of Susan.
Yeah.
You know, in the book, she was kind of told, and we talked about this also with the director, that when she was given her bow and arrow in the first book, you're not to be in battle. And in this book, she, I mean, she's kind of a warrior princess
right.
out there leading the charge. So was that a really favorite choice to modernize her character for this movie?
Definitely. And in the last movie, we had it in mind in that we did not. I do think the books are somewhat colored by Lewis's view of the place of women in the 1940s and 50s, and it just didn't seem really that there was a reason to have her, you know, off to the side because war is for boys. You know, it seemed war shouldn't be for anybody, but if you have to, it should be for everybody.
Did Andrew talk about his discussions with Doug Gresham?
He did. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's where the debate lies. Is, you know, can you get Lewis to say, "Oh, yes, I understand and acquiesce to those things"? But we're big fans of Susan because she's the voice of doubt, or particularly in the first movie. So that much like bitter screenwriters, you know, open the wardrobe door and see a snowy wood. Way of going home, and so she was sort of the voice of that, and I think Anna's great.
Yeah, I mean, you have Anna, and she's got such authority. That person is not sitting back there going, "You guys fight." She's going.
When y'all walked in so quickly, some of us didn't catch who was doing.
I'm Stephen McFeely,
and I'm Chris Marcus.
Chris and Steve.
Yeah. When you do a project like this, and I know you've certainly done a lot of other work, but as a writer, it's almost like you're kind of a freelance type thing. And as soon as you're done with some project, you're kind of trying to move on. Once you've done a project like this, does it kind of cement your future? I mean, it's like, do you know right then that you've got a career, you don't have to sweat it out, you can pay the bills from then on?
I never stop sweating.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of self, what's that word?
Esteem?
Yeah. So, I presume everyone will ultimately not want to hire me. But generally, I'd be very pleased with the outcome of the first one, both critically and commercially, and I think it's a very good version of that book, and the same with this one.
It all depends on the kind of career you want.
Right.
You know, if you want to write only the one kind of movie, then maybe you are set for a period of time. We would like to write every single kind of movie, you know, so you have to keep proving yourself, you know, because Hollywood always wants to put you in a box, and if you've written, you know, a monkey movie, people will go, "Oh, he's great at monkey movies, but he can't write cats." You know, and then you have to go, "Well, hang on, I'll go home and write a cat movie, and then I'll move you." So, you know, you're always having to prove yourself.
Doug Gresham told me this was a poorer book to work from, but it ended up being a better movie.
Mm.
And he elaborated on that, but what do you think he meant by that, and would you concur?
Well, I don't, I mean, I have very, this is actually, you know, read all the books when I was a kid, and when, you know, and they went, I read them when I was a kid and didn't think about them for a very long time, and then when I read them again for this job, this was the one that had, that brought back the most memories for me. And structurally, it's not a, it doesn't stand up exactly as a book, but there are things in it that, to me, resonate stronger than some of the stuff in the other books. So, I know why he's calling it a horror
right.
book, but
structurally, it's not a movie. If you were to transcribe the book, I mean, it's a 180-page book. The kids get there, and then they meet a dwarf named Trumpkin, who tells them a 60-page flashback they're not involved in about a kid we never heard of named Prince Caspian,
yes.
And they say, "Oh, it sounds like he's in trouble. We ought to go do something about that." So,
and
then, it's nearly over. So, one of our first jobs, I was reading this last night, that we we wrote a memo, and he doesn't even remember this. We wrote a memo in December of 2004 after we got the job, while everyone else was still finishing Lion and the Witch, which didn't come out until December of 2005, saying, all right, when you're ready and come up for air, here's the good things, here's the bad things, right? And what we have to all agree on is that somebody's blowing that horn really, really early, much earlier than before, because these kids have to get here, and Cassie's got to be here, and then they're going to be in the middle. Yes, and if we don't agree on that, then I don't know how we're going to do this movie. Mm-hmm. So with that kind of decision had to be made, particularly, you know, really early on.
What are some of those things that resonated strongly?
I remember loving that part where they find the ruined Care Paravel and find the little chess piece. It blew my 10-year-old mind to think about, you know, okay, they were there. And now it's a ruin. And it's also the kind of thing that I think Lewis is so good at he makes you go out to the backyard and hunt around for maybe there's a ruin in over there by the garage. So that part really got me charged up and poking around in the crevices.
How would you describe, for lack of a better term, the theological theme of the book? And the whole set piece in the middle with the storming of the castle.
Yeah.
The consequences for Peter's act
was
totally new, but
right.
You were trying to, I assume you're trying to make it consistent with
right.
the theme.
I don't know about theologically, but on a character level, I think, you know, Peter and Cassie, and particularly Peter in that sequence, is dealing with pride.
Yeah.
You know, he has been one thing, it has been taken away from him, and now he's trying to figure out who am I and you know, how do I prove it? And that raises a huge failure on his part. And we really wanted to give him that because he can come across as sort of stiffly heroic, particularly Peter, in that he's, you know, he's the leader, he wins, blonde. You know.
Just have a young, handsome boy.
I even bear resentment from when I was a dorky little kid in the class. But so we really wanted to test his mettle and break it a little bit so that he could build himself back up into a real person.
That's part of the story necessitated that kind of thing in that you have two people occupying similar places. You've got two young future kings who ought to be the king of Narnia. So we knew they were going to have to, there was going to be conflict and friction there. We wanted to give them one big thing that had consequences. So I'm really pleased with that middle section because we always knew we wanted to have the Narnians interacting with humans on the humans' terms, right? Because the last movie, you had no humans other than the White Witch. Right? And we wanted a cityscape. We wanted a castle. We wanted to be able to do that. But we also wanted them to try something and fail and get people killed. Right? I mean, I'm real proud of the gravity of a lot of this. I mean, it is described as a grittier film, and it is. But I hope not so much so that it turns people off. I just think it ups the stakes a little bit.
Can you talk about why Lucy sees Aslan and the children die?
That's a question of faith, I guess.
Yeah.
And to go to the earlier question about, and I can't speak for Lewis, but in my conversations with Gresham, kind of sussed this out, is that for Lewis, the return to Narnia, the Prince Caspian, is a discussion or is about what happens when people lose faith, when you don't keep Aslan in your windshield and he's in your rearview mirror,
in the car?
Lucy is much more likely to have him in the front, and everybody else is worried about themselves and about their own problems and their pride and things like that.
Well, something, it's a symptom of where they are in life,
Right.
The three older kids, particularly Susan and Peter, have had to face adolescence / adulthood in England for a year. And so now, they are really trying to figure out where they fit in Narnia, and she is
has remained a little more focused on the
key. An innocent fate?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, her stories have always been at left-centered. I mean, she's pretty clear-eyed about that.
What does the opening scene with Peter, the fight on the subway, about him?
Well, that's us. I mean, we were really interested. This is a thing that Lewis doesn't explore particularly. Mm-hmm. But we were really interested in what happens if you are a king or queen in Narnia for 15 years to the point where you aged into a completely different actor by the end of the movie, and you've got a beard and all this, and you want to back through the wardrobe, and you're a kid just like when you left, and then you know, you got to go back to school, and then you've got school for a year, right? And whereas you were signing treaties and defeating giants and bringing people together, you're now doing homework and not going to the prom or whatever, right? That prom, 1940.
Sure.
So that was the issue. We wanted to show, the tough time that at least Peter's had, and sort of what the attitude everyone else had towards that year off.
Now, related to that, I mean, I mentioned this earlier. This film exemplifies great change for a lot of people in a lot of different situations.
Yeah.
In your estimation as writers, what character had to make the greatest change or the greatest sacrifice?
Who gives up the most?
Because, I mean, obviously you have Prince Caspian, put his life on the line.
Yeah, but Prince Caspian, I think, realizes he's unready. I guess I would say Peter, just because Peter deserves, he deserves to be back. And ultimately realizes that Narnia would be better off without him, you know, with under Caspian. Mm-hmm. So I would say the early answer would be Peter. And strangely, I was seeing it last night. I was struck by how much Peter's story steps up. You know, it's really maybe it's just the battle scenes or that one on one fight. It's really and he has certainly the most culpability.
I have a secret question.
Please.
If C.S. Lewis were here in this room, what would you say to him? That's the first part of the question. Second part of the question is, I'm curious to hear how you dealt with the challenges of the writer's strike and how it affected the third movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
If C.S. Lewis was here, I would shake his hand. Thank you for the house payments. No, I mean, what can you say? I think I would speak to him as the kid who read the books when he was... I mean, with 8 and 10, and, you know, he stretched my mind a little wider, and beyond that.
Yeah, and my hope would be that he'd like the movies. I'm going to take Doug's word on that. I mean, I know he was anti-movie, you know, during his day, but let's face it, if you were going to make The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe when C.S. Lewis was alive, it was going to be a pump and stuff flying at the end. See. So, you know, that's going to ruin the magic a little bit. So, you know, once we got to a point where that line looks real, I would hope that he, you know, then it's just a matter of if the technology is up to you now, you know, who's in charge of the story and are they staying true to, you know, what he would like to see in the story. So my hope is that he would be he would pat me on the head. And as far as the writer's strike is concerned, we laid things down and fix signs up and marched in a circle.
I would suspect that the third film would be the biggest challenge because the first one seems to be character driven.
Yeah.
This one is action driven, and action films tend to, once they start doing the action thing, they got to do more action and more action.
You fear that there will be too much action in Don Treader and not a lyrical journey of spiritual discovery.
That's exactly how I was going to put it.
Duly noted, sir.
How about a lyrical journey of spiritual action? I've got a question about something that was in the book that was left out of the movie, which a lot of people will probably think is great. The old Greek characters that come and they celebrate and all that.
Right.
Well, give me kind of your thought process on why you left that out.
Yeah, I mean, I actually like them in that I like that kind of
pantheistic thing that Lewis gets into, where there, you know, you have Greek mythology showing up, and Roman mythology, and Norse things, and, you know, he really gets a nice sort of mythical soup going. I think it's just basically...
It's a long movie now. So when you would you have to know who he is? Because then you got to explain it, and then you're just grinding it to a halt to say, this is...
Yeah, and then also, I mean, I think he has two or three big party dance sequences in his book, and in two of them, at least, before the problem is solved, you know, and I think audiences are going to go, why are they having
a I thought it was very important that he get there.
There's a war on.
But it was certainly there.
That is what Fallen's good.
But that's certainly discussions we have.
But that's one of those, you got to kind of bite back and kill your darlings when you're doing these things, because there are things in every book where you're like, I love that, but I can't put it in a movie.
We would have had a lot more paw-sucking bear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I could make a Bulgy Bear movie, I'd probably.
One of my favorite characters actually in the film was Edmund. But it's really in the scheme of both movies. Just talk about that a little bit, because you're seeing him live out.
Well, that's the thing. We always were worried about Edmund because he had the biggest change and fixed the most about himself in the first one. So it would be really unfair to both audience and actor and Edmund the character to have him be a little crud muffin at the beginning of this movie. Like, oh, you remember that thing I went through? That really, really
didn't
take. So then what do? You start with a character who's pretty noble and has his head on his shoulders, and he's not, you know, and while his brother's got clearly some issues, and the sister may not want to be there. And so we always looked at him as our Han Solo, you know, that he was going to do the right thing, he was probably going to be a little winky about it, but thankfully, Skander has turned into a handsome actor who's pretty cool.
And he can do deadpan with the best of them. It's just, you know, that scene where he's reading the scroll and I...
he worked out well, but his arc is not as severe as the others because his was so severe in the first one.
Mm-hmm. He did his repenting in the first movie.
He's a well-adjusted little action man now. Good to have him around.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.